Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You scared of things that go boom, boom, boom?
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
Welcome to the Phantasmagorical. My name is Eric 13. I'm here today with Michael Kester.
And look into my eyes. I am happy to be here. No, I said look into my eyes.
Oh boy. Those aren't my eyes, buddy.
Hey, my eyes are down here, asshole.
You beat me to it. I was going to say my first two eyes. Whatever. Doesn't matter. Movie jokes, spoiler jokes. We have got some movies today. One is not from 2008, and neither is the other.
Okay, so we're doing... this is probably the most important article in a double feature title ever. The Changeling.
Uh-huh.
And then we're pairing that with Gothic, with no A at the end. No article at the end,
right.
Article at the beginning. Not to be confused with another potential disaster of a pair, Changeling and Gothica, which I think probably came out in 2008 also.
Oh, you're just asking for a year-end show there. If we didn't already have a better year-end planned, it would be Changeling and Gothica. Not only is there this 2008 film called Changeling, which I heard like doesn't even have specters in it.
No.
But
well, I mean, it has the director.
There is virtually one Changeling every decade.
Sure.
Which just makes this impossibly hard. But we're doing, you know, the one with the spooky chair.
Right.
Like you would expect on double feature.
We're eliminating all possibilities of a contrived Changeling palooza on year 15 by covering the Changeling one right now.
I actually think the 2008 one might be one of the ones with the article.
No, it's not.
Not that anybody cares about this.
I'm
going to
go with no. You're
okay,
thinking of a different article with an invisible chair.
Look, here's the quick device. If it's on double feature and there's a lot of movies, see if any of them have haunted furniture. And then that's the
one
we're doing.
That won't work when you're talking about Changeling. Other Changeling also is tangentially related to an empty chair that gets a lot of attention.
Oh my God.
Again.
It's a Clint Eastwood film, guys. Remember? Because Invisible President. No, you don't remember those times. Remember when that was ridiculous? Now if someone yelled at an empty chair, you'd be like, yeah, no, I see what's going on here.
Mm-hmm. Oh, captain, my president. Yeah.
God. We're going to spoil the films. We're going to spoil just the films. That's all we're spoiling.
If you haven't seen, I mean, The Changeling is one of those movies that everybody has seen until you mention it, in which case no one's seen it. It's one of those movies where everybody, it's talked about widely as one of the great horror movies. And then you point randomly at a crowd and everyone in the crowd has not seen it.
Yeah.
And then Gothic is a film. We'll get to where I found this movie, but I found it in, I argue, the best place to find a movie. And Changeling, believe it or not, Gothic, my pick. Guilty.
Uh-huh.
Changeling, not my pick.
I'm going to take credit. This is John's movie, actually. When in doubt, say it's John's movie.
Go ahead and take credit.
I was going to take credit. Well, because I really wanted to see it, but John reads my mind. And then
we talk about this a lot, but sometimes y'all suggest movies and we're like, cool, I wanted to do that anyway.
Well, let's be honest. John's had a million movies on this show.
That's true.
It's because John is an active Patreon. That's at patreon.com/double feature. We have got some new Patreons on there who were like, oh, I didn't know that I could get some movies on the show this way. And we're doubly excited. And this makes me happy because I think this is the coolest fucking part. They were excited to see what we would pair the movies with.
There we go.
Which is great because that's what the service provides. That's really mm-hmm. all you get here. I mean, you get this show too, but I don't know how valuable that is.
Yeah.
But what you do get is a human curated recommendation engine. And in a day and age when robots are trying to take that job from you and I, I appreciate people still coming back to human curation and going, what does this get double featured with? And today, patreon.com/double feature. Today, we got a bunch of people running around houses being fucking spooked.
Yeah, and it's tangentially involving writers and tangentially involving true story. That's.
Did you get a little co-inspired last week? Is that what happens?
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah, based on the truth and lies is one of your favorite expressions.
Yeah, it's my go-tos.
It's one of those great things on our show, which I think sarcastically was your favorite for a while. And then like you went, truth and lies, you know, like angry. And then at some point the sarcasm just wore off and you're like, oh, the truth and lies. Interesting.
Very sure, because it's one of those things where you can say and sound wise, and then reality, it doesn't mean anything because literally everything is just based on the truth and lies.
So when we talk about the themes of movies and we talk about the conflicts of movies, sometimes there is person versus themselves. Sometimes there's person versus nature. Person versus house really is my favorite conflict. I never learned about that in English class.
Person versus house is a good one.
We didn't cover person versus house. I don't know why. That's kind of, I mean, Gothic is not going to be as much person versus house, but I'll fucking accept the Changeling as person versus house.
Sure. Well, this is the prequel to Firestarter. So this is where we find out where Uncle loses his eye.
Yeah.
But it's about, this is a sleuthy movie. I didn't expect it to be as sleuthy as every time we go back. This had a lot of, we did Don't Look Now earlier on the year, and it had a lot of similar vibes. And
oh, hell yeah.
The thing that stood out having watched these in relatively nearby succession, I wouldn't say double feature succession because we know that didn't happen, but still in relatively close succession with each other is that Succession. I'm going to go with Succession.
I was just going to go with it.
Succession. Secession is the Texas thing.
Split up California. Too big. It's too big to fail.
Is that the movies that I think kind of live as the big staple horror movies that people look back at and go, these are the great ones. Not just these two, but also movies like The Innocents. Basically pre-1980, right? So pre-slasher, pre-exorcist. All the horror movies that had these wide appeals that weren't monster movies, the psychological sort of stuff, are all really similar in that there is a really coherent plot. Not something I'm necessarily used to in a horror movie,
sure,
but definitely an airtight fact about this movie.
Well, yeah, a movie today might say, there's a bunch of spook in this house. Ooh, I wonder why. And a movie back then, after ooh, I wonder why, goes, we better solve it within the running time of this film.
Yeah, otherwise no one's going to come see this.
Right.
People are here right, for answers. Yeah. We're going to pull the Scooby-Doo mask off the house.
Yeah, Don't Look Now was another good example. That's a kind of double feature that would be almost too fucking on the nose. But... you know, I watched this at proper 3 a.m. for a movie like this is just totally when you want to do that. 2 a.m. I feel like is, you know, VHS era.
Extra.
What Lurks on Channel X.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally extra. And there's a little of that in this movie. What I like about the tone of this movie is that it's got the tact of, you know, fine art 70s cinema, but with the plot points of 80s VHS era nonsense. Where getting back to that question you were talking about, the fucking key revelations in this movie are done through not just seance, but later the senator arrives in the climax of the movie via astral projection. I mean, it's just like when you get the answers are bonkers. they're like total craziness, but they exist within the framework of, you know, tried and true spookery. So it doesn't seem, it's not a Deus Ex Machina thing where they're just inventing, you know, astral projection exists within the world of folklore. So it doesn't just seem like, oh, we needed everyone to come to the climax of the movie. We're going to hit a button and make that happen. And so there's this payoff to the movie that is, I feel like, very 80s VHS-y.
Sure.
You know, and this is sort of, it's a little less true of when we did a movie like Don't Look Now, but the build of this movie is the part that I think is most valuable to it, in looking at how these movies do. I guess the makeup is a slow burn movie and then a giant payoff.
Right.
So it's not just a matter of like bringing the tension along, but ending in total catastrophe in the biggest way you possibly can.
Yeah, you said that you think the best time to watch a movie like The Changeling is at 3 a.m. And I would argue, I would say the best time to watch, let me rephrase this, make it more specific. The best time for a movie like The Changeling to be aired on your local programming television is 12:30 a.m. And here's why.
Mm-hmm.
The average person will be up till 12:30. They'll start The Changeling. And they will pass out and wake up and remember The Changeling was a solid movie. You and I will stay up because you can't stop. If you stop a movie in the middle of it's like if you die in a dream. Like if you don't complete a movie after starting a movie, mm-hmm. you die. We die. I die.
Yeah.
I can't watch movies in segments. And so you and I will finish it and we will go, ah, yes, that was a solid movie. Uh-huh. But it appeals to both audiences by the slow burn is so rock solid. And I don't want to say the word delicate because it's not, but.
Well, that's what I mean though, about that sort of finesse that it just feels like complete art house 70s cinema.
Yeah. Yeah.
But then at the same time, it's just sort of it, you know, the ghost stuff is as ridiculous as ghost stuff ever is.
Right.
I mean, until we get to Gothic, but except for that. Gothic is somehow, this is the 3 a.m. movie that somehow goes to Gothic, which is a midnight movie. And maybe it has something to do with that nap you take in the middle. Maybe you've hit the key there.
Yeah.
When you said that, I immediately thought of the scene in Planet Terror, The Missing Reel.
Mm-hmm.
You fall asleep on your couch watching the movie. You wake up, you're like, why is everything on fire?
Yeah.
What happened?
Yeah.
Look around. I was following this. Yeah. Fire. Mm-hmm. That's what's happening. I didn't fall asleep. That's good. Now, if you fall asleep, you miss the part where we have to like look up things on microfiche, which is a very important part of any film like this. Yeah. The mystery and going on and sort of solving the, you know, the other thing that I think ties people to the mystery and is something that should be sung about the film is that the mystery isn't just in there. I think the tension leads you to the mystery. So, you know, as the movie continues down the trail and some of these weird things start happening, it chooses to avoid addressing them in such a way as to both add to the tension, but also make you want the answer.
Mm-hmm.
So when you have something like the early bathtub scene with the kid in it, I feel like when you see this in a movie, what you want to cut the tension and why this is such a beautifully, masterfully tense film is you want to at least address the thing that happened. You want the release valve.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're in a house by yourself and you see something and you think it might be a something, I think what you want to do as an audience is at least, you know, sort of turn to the other people you're going through the house with. Imagine you're Scooby-Dooing your way through the house with your flashlight, and one of you thinks you see something. You're going to turn to the other person and be like, you saw that, right? And the act of, you saw that, right? That is the sort of tension relief to go, hold on, I'm not crazy, am I? Is mm-hmm. there a, this is really happening. So when the movie's just proceeding along and then you see a kid in a bathtub and the movie just glosses over it and doesn't at least give you, you know, a stab in the score or any cinematic indication that what you saw is in fact a spooky vision, then you're just sort of going, are we not going to address the fucking kid in the bathtub? And it just lives with you. It just stays with you.
Sure.
And each one of these things that piles on, that's what I mean about a release valve. You just have no time to decompress and go, look, we've seen some weird stuff here. Let's get to the bottom of it. And so you're kind of, I don't know, I feel like you're looking for a release valve in solving the mystery. You're kind of going, well, this dude isn't going to turn to the camera and say, yes, that was quite strange what just happened. It's not just you. So instead, you're like, we got to go to the library and talk to the woman from Poltergeist or what. This is all just behind the mask for me. We got to go figure out what's happening here so that in a way we can at least say it's not in my head, or even more than just it not being in my head. I think we just have some internal desire to resolve something unexplained like this. That's the first thing your brain does. In a lot of ways, it's probably why, you know, thinking back to our years devoted to skepticism on this show, probably why people make up crazy things, because then you can at least point to something and go, oh, obviously it's aliens.
Right.
There, solved it.
Sure.
Now we can at least talk about it. We've identified what it is, so we can start to, there's something psychological that just resolves that for you and makes it feel better. When you don't have that, things stay pretty fucking tense.
Sure. I mean, I feel like the guy, the main guy in this movie, the, you know, creepy two-eyed uncle, he has this, it's sort of a betrayal to the viewer through what you're saying, because he should be way more upset than he is throughout this whole movie.
Yeah, that does it too.
He's very, he goes, a ghost. Okay, so, I mean, like, I just imagine him, you know, this doesn't happen every time, but he sees a ghost. He's like, okay, February 12th, saw a ghost in the bathtub.
Good he wrote it down anyways.
And you're just sitting there like, really? You're just going to note that in case it becomes relevant later.
Yeah.
You know, that's sort of his approach to a lot of it until the chair is flying around the room.
This is a meditative technique, noting.
Yeah.
That's what you do. Yeah. You just go, okay, I saw a ghost. Very interesting. Let's just return to a nice resting place.
Where, and it's also funny because this is set back in the olden times before, you know, we all know without a doubt, oop, got ghosts in your house, built it on top of a dead guy. That's your problem.
Right. I mean, even if the movie gave us as much as watching him walk over to a drawer, open it, take out a notepad and writing down saw a ghost, even that is some acknowledgement
right.
that we don't get.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the best we get as an acknowledgement is the movie doing an extreme zoom into something, which it just starts to give us enough of those that becomes tension building too. So, you know, I start looking around for anything that the movie's doing to at least acknowledge, hey, we know we're doing something scary right now. And the things it gives you are not helpful to releasing that feeling. You know, you get like maybe a riser or something like that, which is the movie, you knowing the movie knows it's doing something scary.
Right.
Which, I mean, so there's that scene with the silver triangle thing on the table.
Mm-hmm.
It's like one of the tensest fucking things. And that's probably a good example of a kind of a classic trick where if you talk about a riser, so in a modern film, maybe you disagree with this, I don't know. But in a modern film, I feel like the risers in sound design are mostly a single note where the pitch gradually increases, or a sound, or like room tone that just, you know, you bring your hand over to the pitch dial and you just keep cranking it up. It's like turning up water until it boils, right?
Mm-hmm.
And back in these movies, the tone of the risers were kind of interesting because they were a little more deliberate instead of like the sort of modulated synthetic, or now we've completely moved past the idea of like a synthesizer. I mean, you're doing this all on a computer. You can just adjust the pitch. But back then, the risers would be, you hold down a note on the keyboard and then you hold down a note that's up the scale and you just never release the notes. Then you add another note and another note. And so you start with a single note and eventually you're playing like a 45 note chord and every single higher note you add to the mix, people are just like, when is this going to stop? When are they going to stop being notes? I can't handle this anymore. And there is some, I mean, I don't really know the human biology to it, but it's almost like the old Dolby surround test, you know, where it sort of drops the low note and then slides back up to this high frequency that surrounds you, and it naturally gives everybody a little buzz. because of it. I don't know mm-hmm. where that comes from biologically, but it's just the coolest thing. And it's, again, perfectly in line with all the other stuff the movie is doing. Pile on, pile on, pile on. Do not give people a fucking release. And you just start winding people. It's this manipulation in cinema where you just start winding people into this fucking pretzel that they can't stand. And then you light their house on fire. And that's kind of the release. It's funny because, you know, when we first looked at the movie in terms of like, people who don't like slow burns talk about them as being boring movies or nothing happens or thinking about plot mm-hmm. points. And so if you fade out, you tune out the movie and then you come back, lighting the house on fire and doing all the crazy specter stuff is the big, oh my God, scare moment. The big climactic effect thing. That's the thing that puts you into emergency alert. But I feel like the viewing of the movie, if you do succumb to its slow torture, for me, when I watch the slow burn movie with the go big ending is the tension relief for me. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, good, we lit the house on fire. Something is happening here. Burning house, I feel like I can point to it and go, yep, see, specters, told you guys. Whereas when you're just wandering around the house and you have a leaky pipe or whatever, then you might be crazy. So lighting the house on fire to me feels like I can at least go, well, we found out what that was about. It's good. It resolves something internally.
So it's funny because this, and this is a minor thing, but this is probably a good semi-transitional anecdotal observation for the Changeling. I knew nothing about this movie at all going into it. I've seen the cover poster a million times and just assumed it was either Spider Baby or whatever happened to Baby Jane.
Yeah.
Because they're sort of in that family. And I've seen both of those. So I'd see the cover of the Changeling and be like, yeah, Changeling, the Spider Jane. I get it.
We're both about that age where these films are just old enough that we can't like distinguish them. I mean, for me, once you get to the 60s, I can't tell any of those films apart. I have mm-hmm. no idea what I've seen or what I haven't seen.
Right. Even if we've done it on the show, you and I tend not to know.
Well, that's probably a different problem, but yeah. And so we're in, what, 1980 for this? So we've passed the 70s. And the 80s was also very distinct.
Right.
It was very like, look at this monster, look at this puppet, look at this creature.
But as we know from 1990 and 2000, the even decades are actually parts of the previous decade. So 1980 is still clearly the 70s, the same way that any slasher movie from 1990 actually came out in the 80s. It's a nature of the fact that production takes less than 0 minutes and more than 0 minutes. And the fact that people don't know what cultural shifts a new decade will bring at the knots. Mm. So I'm watching this movie and I'll tell you what the slow burn is for me is, when's this chair coming into play?
What is the chair going to flip out and start attacking everyone?
What's the chair? Yeah, I mean, you know.
Again, you're waiting for the 80s moment.
The Amityville chairer, yeah.
Where's the killer chair?
And, you know, is there a ghost in the chair? Why aren't we paying more attention to the chair? Mm-hmm. Is this going to be a hamster chair? Are we talking about just some, you know, whatever chair machine? Where's the chair fit into the puzzle? And then when things start going crazy with the chair, I go, I get it. I get why the chair is on the cover of this movie.
Yeah.
Because like you're saying, even though there's a solid hour and 30 minutes before the chair starts going berserk, everything points to, from minute one to minute 90, this chair is about to go berserk. Even if it's not clues to the chair itself, it feels like the payoff to 90 minutes of what is going on.
Yeah.
And in a lesser film, and by a lesser film, I mean a film from, you know, last year, there would be an explanation as to what's going on with the chair.
Yeah, right.
They would tease the chair. They would allude to the chair. The chair would have its own, you know, fucking Mondo poster ahead of the movie coming out.
Right, right.
But instead, the chair just...
I want a Funko of this chair. That's what I'm looking for.
Yeah, exactly. But instead, the film goes, the chair's all you get, man. You're going to be so grateful for the angry chair.
Well, because they want you to fill in what's happening with your mind.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
And I think there is an interesting divide when you talk to people about this movie between the people who talk about it in the same language of, say, something from decades earlier, where, I mean, you can probably even hear it in, like, I talk about this film as a guy who's being rattled and hauntings in his house and blah, blah, blah. And really, I don't even think that's the truth of it. The truth of it is there's a dead kid. Everything mm-hmm. that happens is the dead kid. So some people talk about this film in terms of the boy that is haunting him, what the boy wants, what the boy is saying. And that's probably a more accurate read of the movie. But the presentation of the movie is done in the same way as just a person losing their fucking mind in a house, a la, you know, a Polanski film or something we've covered, like Repulsion or something to that effect. And not to think that I've overlooked your transition into Gothic, I think we can look at some of the creatures in Gothic and some of what happens and, you know, that same question of what's in people's minds versus what are they physically, literally being haunted by, we get a kind of a different set of answers.
Well, and actually, I want to immediately disagree with the last thing you said, is I think that the Changeling begs for 90 minutes, okay, we're going to get to the bottom of this, and Gothic starts with, no, you won't.
Yeah. No, I'd agree with that.
There are no answers to Gothic. It opens with some title cards that make no goddamn sense. It basically goes, here's sort of what you're about to watch. And you go, that's not a plot. And then the movie starts and you go, I understand the title cards now.
Can we also address the opening credits where the tiny skull becomes big?
Yeah.
I'm not really sure what needs to be said about that, but I don't want to look over it. That's all of Gothic for me, is just these pieces that are, you know, when you try to, I feel like unraveling the mysteries of Gothic sort of falls prey to what the movie's doing, because you go, well, don't worry about the tiny skull becoming big. That's not part of the mystery. That's just a thing that happens that fucks with you. And I feel like that's almost every beat of what happens is, no, don't worry about that. That's just some spooky stuff.
Yeah, it's just,
we don't really know what happened there, but
big iron strap on. It's not part of the plot.
Right. And the whole movie, that's all I think, I mean, maybe we're jumping to the end here, but that's all I think the movie is fucking with you over and over.
Yeah. So let me tell you where I found Gothic.
Please.
Way, way, way back when I was about 17 years old.
Mm-hmm.
There was a place called the Charlestown Mall.
Oh, boy.
And in the formative years of the Charlestown Mall, which now lays vacant in St. Charles, Illinois, with only a classic cinemas anchoring it to the foundation.
Oh no, is that true? Is it part of the mall landscape of the United States?
Yes, slowly? Yes. There was a Sam Goody in the Charlestown Mall. And when the Sam Goody, which anybody who's not familiar, anybody who's not from the U.S. or just not familiar with that. So malls are places where goth kids get their first jobs, walk around so their parents aren't there, and bug cooler goth kids who are actually nerdier goth kids who have jobs at the places at the mall. That's what malls are. And you buy nothing and you spend hours there.
Mm.
And then Sam Goody was a entertainment chain like FYE or Tower Records or, you know, the one section of Best Buy that looks like a bomb went off.
Yeah.
That was Sam Goody. And Sam Goody was going out of business because
piracy.
And
and you're supposed to say that softer, not louder.
You wouldn't steal a car. So they were liquidating all their shit, and they had this box set section, you know, and you can imagine these DVD cases, 13 hours of movies, seven movies, one box set, $5. And they were box sets of old fucking public domain horror movies, or next to public domain. And I bought everything. That's what taught me about Gamera. And they were all in little collections. So there was Giant Monsters, and that was just Gamera because that was cheap. And there was the Walking Dead or the Living Dead and the zombies, mm-hmm. right? A bunch of old fucking like City of the Dead is on there, like a Fulci shit, you know, like yeah. really, but it's like terrible prints.
Yeah.
I mean, it looks like it's running on fucking MS-DOS.
right. Night of the Living Dead.mpeg.
Right. Yeah. But one of these box sets and the one that was quickly my favorite was called Horrorlicious.
Ooh.
And what I now know in retrospect is that Horrorlicious was sexploitative horror movies, 9 of them.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know this at the time. I just knew that that was the box set that had the weirdest, most video nasty, you know, pics on it.
Yeah.
And the first one on Horrorlicious, the one that started the whole box set, was Gothic.
Is the one with the goat. All I've wanted all year long is to live deliciously. And here we are in Gothic. And I feel like it does fulfill the promise of the,
yeah.
the horror erotic.
Yeah.
In the most Ken Russell altered states way
so
one possibly could hope for.
So now imagine my parents have gone to bed. I'm up. It's, you know, 2 a.m. with, do you remember Jeff Austin, who we used to go to IHOP with?
No, but sure.
So him and I go, I got this, and I put it in to 17-year-old boys, and then Gothic is on the screen for 90 minutes.
That's great.
And I never watched it again. I just knew it existed. And then when we were going to do The Changeling, I was like, you know what deserves a rewatch and what I should put some other folks through? And I swear to God, all I remembered from the first viewing was I knew what the premise was, that it's like some bullshit about how Mary Shelley had a scary, spooky weekend and then wrote the greatest novel of all time.
Exact synopsis of the film. I don't know why you don't have a job copywriting.
And then I also remember eyeball nipples. Those are the two things.
Yeah. Well, it stays with you like a Nightmare on Elm Street type.
Oh my God. Yeah. Yeah.
Thing that fucks up your childhood.
But so on the rewatch as an adultish, I'm sitting here going, okay, so I'm sure this is going to like kind of drag, be on and off. It's clumsy. It's weird. No one's heard of it. This can't be a real movie. Somehow Gabriel Byrne is involved. And then there'll be eyeball nipples and we'll be able to talk about the Mary Shelley aspects. And I'm watching this movie and I fucking swear to God, somebody went back and put way more crazy shit in the movie. Because I remembered none of the equally, if not crazier shit than the eyeball nipples.
There's something about the mere existence of the movie. You know, I go back so often to tone in movies.
Mm-hmm.
And it's such a ambiguous thing to try and talk about. So, you know, I've been trying to really start pinning down when in my head I'm just going, wow, that movie felt weird. What can we talk about? Where am I feeling? Where's the first time I'm sitting there going, hey, I'm watching a weird fucking movie, aren't I?
To me, it's when they get off the fucking boat in the very first shot of the movie.
Hell yes. Hell yes. Well, it's so big and it's so cinematic and the clothing and the music flourishes as they frolic. I mean,
it feels like a movie that's going, the opening scenes, the boat, them getting off the boat, the performances, the exaggerated language. It feels like the movie is going, that's right, for the first time on film, the number one theatrical production in the world of Gothic.
Percy Shelley is so camp. I feel like he's doing Frankenfurter.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's just wild. I watch it and I can't believe I'm looking around thinking, dude, what's happening? What am I seeing? It is. It's an over the top sort of theatrical production. I mean, I know, you know, we're talking about European and then we start talking about theater and looking at that through American eyes, maybe there's a little bit of, feel like we've been also going back to Uncanny Valley a lot this year, but that's a little of what it feels like. It's sort of a lost in translation. It should read like a normal movie, and the things that it's do. The music's the biggest one. I think the music, if you had different music in this movie, it becomes a lot more normal and a lot less special. But the music is it's so big and whimsically, I'm in a horror movie. It's so excited to be here, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's just this, the movie is such a left hook to anything, any of your expectations. If you're expecting a horror movie, this is way too much fun. If you're expecting a period piece, technically. If you're expecting an historical interpretation of the greatest first horror novel of all time, sorely mistaken. In fact, I would argue that the only time you can go to Gothic with an expectation that's accurate is the second time you watch it. I don't think even you or I, to Podmanity listening on the show, I don't think there's any amount of dissecting where we can really encapsulate. This is doing us a great disservice. Don't listen to the podcast. We're not doing anything right. But there's nothing on, you know how you and I talk about how you develop this sixth sense. You're able to read the block lettering at the bottom of a one sheet and go, yes or no, I'm not interested, or I am.
Yeah, sure.
Just by names, different things, production houses. Like, you and I are able to go, you know, people go in, they go, wow, that poster looks like a good movie. And you and I get closer and go, it will suck. And we never talk about it again.
Sure.
Gothic betrays that in every way. There is no close reading of everything in front of you that sets you up for the movie you're sitting down to watch. Except 13 hours of nonstop horror madness, 9 films in one box set, horrorlicious.
Yeah, right. Well, it is the type of movie that, you know, I think that is a praise of the film.
And
that,
absolutely. Oh my God, yeah.
The place our show exists really is the same feeling as talking about The Changeling, where something is happening and you want to turn to another person and go, what the fuck? And I think, you know, whereas The Changeling, you had that inner struggle with the characters and yourself in the movie, because Gothic makes no attempt to give you, because you kind of realize you need to give that feeling up as you watch it, that this movie's not going to help you with that.
Mm-hmm.
You then need to find a person in your life to turn to and go, this fucking Gothic, you see this right now? And so I think after you watch it, you could literally watch it again the next day and you'll probably have the same reaction with another person sitting there, mm-hmm. which is just to go, this is wild, isn't it? And on the, you know, just at the level of what this movie's about, it could be, there's a read of this from the synopsis that could be a lot more straightforward, because it's kind of, we did this movie on additional content, I think, called Insignificance. Wasn't that? That was the one where, so this is the movie where Albert Einstein, Marilyn Monroe, Joe DiMaggio, and Joseph McCarthy.
Oh my God. That? Yeah. Yeah.
So it's kind of this unlikely meeting of the minds that may or may not have happened. And so if you, there is a movie. If I just pitch you a movie and I go, what if all of these authors spent this weekend, and it has some basis in history. This probably happened. They spent this weekend and on a dare, they all sort of wrote stories and spooky events happened. You go, okay, there's a movie there. There's a lot to chew on. But then Gothic sort of sets that aside and just does its other crazy thing.
Mm-hmm.
I can see why this story's been adapted in a couple formats, because there are various takes. There are several pretty straightforward ways to address that story.
Mm-hmm.
How Frankenstein, you know, how someone came up with Frankenstein. But Gothic doesn't do any of those. It's mm-hmm. not interested in any of that at all. Instead, it's like this mashup of, you know, Rocky Horror and Holy Mountain or something crazy like that. And then when it eventually does get around to the writing of Frankenstein, it's like a fucking afterthought. It happens in between scenes, based on almost like, oh yeah, by the way, weren't we doing something here? Oh yeah, writing Frankenstein. Don't forget to put that scene in. Anyways. And then the movie ends with, instead of any of these biopic movies, I'm going to propose this, future movies can use this. Instead of ending your biopic, as we've seen so many times on Double Feature, with inner titles.
Ugh.
The sort of paragraphs on black background telling the audience what everybody's fate was.
how Chris Kyle died for real?
The correct way to do this is to have a man on a boat shout it over a megaphone. I mean, I don't. This is a solved problem at this point. Amazing. I don't know why we keep back to paragraphs on text. You get a megaphone, you get on the boat, and you just go, this is what happened to the characters. The end. Show credits. Movie over.
No, show baby. Show credits. The end.
Movie over. Show over. Double feature. Still to continue. And that is patreon.com/double feature. Thank you so much for allowing us to continue on and do episodes like this. This is really great. We are nearing the end of the month. Of course, that is always the crunch to try to scrape together the last minute funds to continue the show. But you guys have been showing up for us as usual every month except this month. But, you know, we got like another week or two left here, and that's just kind of how it goes. So now is the time. If you could hop on the Patreon, patreon.com/double feature. A big thanks to everyone over there. Our executive producers are Abbott of Unreason, Ben Ecker, Billy Wilson, Brett Hayton, Bruno Hunziker, Charles Crawford, Mark Abbott, Tom Leonard, and John, who
is back.
Sort of, I guess, recommended this movie. I mean, he did, and I did, and you did. We all just recommended movies, and we got it together. It's such a good idea. We don't even remember whose idea it was. That's not what's important, you know, when you have this collaborative relationship. Blah, blah, blah. What are we doing next time?
Next time on the show, we're taking a week off, guys, from your picks. I had you for a minute.
I was like, I get a week off. That hasn't happened in literally 11 years.
We're taking a week off from your picks, and we're doing against... This one took a little tooth pulling, but I mean, you know, that's really all the tooth pulling it ever takes. Once I got Hot Tub Time Machine, I was like, I can get anything. And then I went, how about a Spike Lee movie? And you went, and then I went, please. And you're like, okay, fine. So next week we're going to do, it's definitely one of his lesser known Black Klansmen. It's called Get on the Bus. It's, you're gonna think it's, you know, from before Do the Right Thing, but it is firmly in the mid-90s mm-hmm. that this one was made. It's, you know, based on the Truth and Lies. And then we're gonna pair that with so there's a thing about the other movie. It's called Chan is Missing, and part of the reason that I wanted to cover this, and actually part of the reason that I wanted to cover both of these movies, is I wanted to look at representation in cinema. I know, but wait, there's more.
wait, come back.
Representation in cinema in something that you and I are really, really comfortable with, right? So kind of road movies, but with Black people and Chinese people, right?
Yeah, and specifically in America too.
In America.
Right. So yeah. It's African-American and Chinese-American movies completely in the sense of those terms. And I also do want to say, having just seen the movies, you're totally right. It's a fantastic double feature. I mean, I don't know if it'll be a great show, guys. I don't want to overpromise here. But no, it'll be a great show next time. It was a fantastic double feature. I'm very, very happy we did it. And if people are sort of on the fence about watching the movies, I'd encourage them to do it anyways.
So it's Spike Lee's Get on the Bus and Chan is Missing. Watch more fucking film.
Bye.
This program is a proud member of the Battleship Pretension Fleet.